Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court issues two big rulings on religious liberty and the Affordable Care Act. How did the justices come down, and what do these cases say about the Roberts Court? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. The Supreme Court summer break is almost here, and for a couple of weeks now, court watchers have been expecting a big opinion, only to be disappointed. But the justices made up for that on Thursday by issuing two big rulings. Let's start with Fulton v. Philadelphia. This was the Catholic foster care case. Catholic Social Services has had a foster care contract with the city of Philadelphia for more than 50 years, but it said that its religious beliefs would not allow it to certify a gay couple to serve as a foster family. And as a result of that, Bill, Philadelphia let its contract lapse, hence this court case. And the headline, or at least one headline, is that the court ruled unanimously 9-0 against Philadelphia. So, Bill, what was your read of this ruling?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that on one level. A 9-0 decision is pretty good, and it's not something to sneer at today when we have such a fractured court. On the other hand, I think if you look at the actual decision the reason that is it Catholic Charities or Catholic Services prevailed, it's because the general contracts that Philadelphia gives out, their law allows for an exemption from their rules. And the court basically said, so long as your law allows for an exemption, you can't deny a religious exemption on this. So it's a very narrow victory. And the most interesting part of it is not the majority opinion. It's a concurrence, with the result, but really a dissent with the logic and the limited nature of the ruling, in which Sam Alito pointed out that all Philadelphia has to do to prevail, to do what it wants, is just eliminate the exemptions for anyone. And then they're back at square one. And this is part of a broader religious freedom argument, that has to do with other Supreme Court precedents, like the Smith case, where Scalia, of all people, ruled that a general law generally applicable to everyone, that there's should be no exemptions for religions. And so long as that's there, that's a big obstacle to what I think, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas say, and maybe Justice Gorsuch would like to see.
To get into the weeds on that just a little bit more. So the precedent that Bill's citing here is Employment Division v. Smith. It was a 1990 case, and it involved Native Americans who had been fired for using peyote in religious rituals. And then they applied for unemployment benefits and were denied those unemployment benefits by the state. And the gist of the ruling was that the ban on peyote wasn't aimed at anyone's religion. It was a general rule with some incidental burdens placed on religion, but it didn't make any exceptions. And so the Native Americans lost that case. And just to underline Bill's point about the narrowness of this Philadelphia ruling, basically what the majority, six justices in the majority, said was that this contract, the foster contract that Philadelphia had, allowed the city to make exemptions, even though it didn't in practice actually make any exemptions. And then here's what the chief justice wrote. The city offers no compelling reason why it has a particular interest in denying an exception to CSS, that's Catholic Social Services, while making them available to others, unquote. And so, Kim, I have the same question as Bill and as Justice Alito, which is, are we just going to get this case back in 2 years when the next round of contracts eliminates that clause?
Right. So, to step back, I think more broadly, what we had here was an opportunity for the Supreme Court to look again at a precedent that is becoming very difficult in what is increasingly a more intolerant and secular society that is constantly encroaching on religious liberty. So this was the opportunity. And instead of doing that, he basically did an end run and said, well, this precedent doesn't even really apply in this case because of the exception that's available to Catholic social services. And therefore, we don't really need to get there. And, you know, I agree. That's a huge miss, because what you're fundamentally doing is relying on the notion that Philadelphia will maintain that exception. And of course, as Bill just noticed, if you don't, then you're right back to square one. And what was very compelling about Justice Alito's concurrence is that, you know, he put out there a number of arguments of other scenarios where this could apply. They haven't necessarily. But it isn't far-fetched to imagine it, given the way that we're seeing growing attacks on religious organizations. Just look, for instance, at the Little Sisters of the Poor, who object to Obamacare's contraception rule. They've now had to go to the Supreme Court twice. The Biden administration has made it clear that they're going to continue going after the nuns. And so by dodging these things, you're not really settling the issues. You're just leaving a lot of confusion out there. And I would just add one thing that I found also a little disappointing about this is that the Chief Justice's opinion managed to get the support of the two newest members of the court, Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh. But had they joined Alito in his concurrence, the court would have had a 5-4 majority for a much stronger statement protecting religion. So there was a lot of different decisions and opinions here, but that's a kind of clearer way of looking at it. Those two justices, they decided to stick with the Chief Justice.
Yeah, a couple more facts that maybe relate to the question of whether this case is going to come back, and also to the Little Sisters of the Poor, who have been to the Supreme Court twice now. In the record for the Philly case, there's no evidence that there was any gay couple that actually ever approached Catholic Social Services and asked to be certified as a foster family. And in that case, Catholic Social Services said they would happily refer that couple to any of the other two dozen agencies in the city that also do the same sort of certification. And so in a plural society, I mean, one solution to a problem like this is live and let live. You know, let the baker Jack Phillips in Colorado bake the cakes he wants to bake, and people who want a cake for a gay wedding can go to the baker across the street. But Bill, to be optimistic here, if you're trying to see the silver lining here for religious liberty, there was a strong majority, 6 justices, including the court's three liberals, who said, first of all, that adoption, foster families, does not count as a public accommodation. And second of all, one of the arguments that Philadelphia tried to make here is, hang on, we're not regulating the public. This is we're in a managerial role here. We are managing our contractors for a city service. And Bill, a silver lining would be that no justice bought that argument. Even the three liberals said that it didn't matter that this was in the context of a city contract for a city service.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I mean, in a sense, a 9-0 case is something, especially on religious freedom on this. But the reason that it is 9-0, I think, is because it's so narrow and so limited that I think even the progressives on the court didn't think it was much of a threat. I think what it shows is sooner or later, the court is going to have to address Employment Division versus Smith. Judge Barrett, I believe, said she wasn't sure what would replace that if they threw Smith out. But I think that's going to have to be addressed. And these things are coming up. You know, you mentioned Jack Phillips, the Colorado cake baker. You know, his odyssey started, you know, almost 10 years ago when he refused to bake a cake celebrating a same-sex wedding. And he was pursued all the way to the Supreme Court, which again ruled for him, but very narrowly. Just this week, a Colorado court has gone through the whole thing again. This time it's a transgender cake. And it just seems that there is this disposition on the left to just not only win, but to humiliate and defeat their opponents. You know, it used to be in the old days, if you thought someone had bad practices and discriminated or something against you, you would boycott them, right? And hope other people joined you out of solidarity. Now, the emphasis is to get these people to force them to cry uncle and violate their beliefs. And that's, I mean, you kind of intimated this, but that is not a prescription for social harmony.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Moving on to the long concurring opinion by Justice Alito, Justice Samuel Alito, 77 pages, much longer than the majority opinion, which is interesting in and of itself. I mean, he does raise the question of, are we just going to get this case back? He says, if Philly changes its contract, then voila, today's decision will vanish and the parties will be back where they started. But what's interesting about this, Kim, is that he also makes a case as an originalist. He goes through the analysis of the original meaning of the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, and he cites things like a 1777 constitution in the state of Georgia that protected religious exercise, quote, provided it be not repugnant to the peace and safety of the state, unquote. And that is, looks like to me, Kim, a much broader standard, a much broader protection for religious exercise than what we have right now under this Smith decision.
Right. And the correct protection of religious exercise. And he gives other examples of this. And it was really kind of neat to not only read that originalist interpretation, but the whole history of this. It's a compelling decision. And he put a lot of time into it. But, you know, as we note in our editorial, and I'll go back to this again, is that it's even more important these days, because if you think back to the time when he was talking about and talking about colonial times, you know, this was a far more religious country. And so these kind of shields, it's notable that they were in existence even then, but we need them even more now, because we increasingly do live in a very secular society that is constantly attacking religious exercise. And so, you know, we gave a couple of examples in our editorial. Imagine laws prohibiting infant circumcision, something that, by the way, was proposed in San Francisco in 2010. Or imagine banning the slaughter of animals without first rendering them unconscious, which is something that is already been enacted in parts of Europe, you know, even though it would outlaw kosher and halal slaughter, which is an offense to many people's religions. So we're getting these kind of secularist laws on the books that are increasingly encroaching on the exercise of religion and religious liberty. And that's why, again, it wasn't just that Judge Alito said this is going to come back to us again, but the court just whiffed on an opportunity to provide a lot stronger protections of the sort that this country began with.
But does that make a broader decision on the Smith precedent almost inevitable? I mean, that's clearly what Justice Neil Gorsuch thinks. He also had a concurrence. I'll read part of it. He says, Justice Alito has offered a comprehensive opinion explaining why Smith should be overruled, and not a single justice has lifted a pen to defend the decision. So what are we waiting for, unquote? And Bill, I'd put that question to you. What are the justices waiting for?
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the problems is, you know, they can't avoid it forever. And remember last summer, Clarence Thomas said, this is why we're given lifetime appointments, to be able to decide the big cases. You know, Kim alluded to Justice Roberts before. And I think, you know, when I watch him, explain what he's doing and talk and sort of try to weigh these political considerations. It really brings me back to his nomination, you know, when he promised balls and strikes. And my own opinion is that Justice Roberts would probably be like an Alito or something more reliably conservative voice if he weren't Chief Justice. I think once he became Chief Justice, he thought about the Roberts Court and the reputation of the Roberts Court. I don't think that has been a good thing, because what it seems is that they're just avoiding some big decisions. But these things aren't going away, whether it's affirmative action, whether it's religious liberty, whether it's guns, they're not going away. And in fact, the litigation below in the district and appellate courts is multiplying.
But what do you make of the fact, Kim, that the two newest justices, Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, both joined into the Chief Justice's argument here? And some commentators are saying, we don't really have a 6-3 court, six conservatives and three liberals. We have a 3-3-3 court with three on each side, and then these three led by the Chief Justice in the middle, who are very unpredictable.
It remains to be seen, and I think we need to watch. I guess I'd make two points on this. One is, let's not forget that both Amy Coney Barrett and in particular Brett Kavanaugh had some pretty bruising confirmation hearings in which they were accused of a great number of things, none of which, of course, were true. But, you know, for instance, Amy Coney Barrett, everyone said that if she was put on the court, it would be the death knell for Obamacare. This is notable because the other opinion that came out this week was actually one upholding Obamacare, in which she also joined with the Chief Justice. So they had a pretty rough time of it. We'll see how much of these initial terms of theirs are about joining with the chief to try to support his clear mission, which is very obvious now he's on, to show unanimity more on the court and try to lessen the politicization around the court. And I just don't think we know yet. Sometimes justices, as they go along, they kind of come more into their own, and we'll just have to watch where they are. But the other thing that I think that's incredibly important, and why it's also impossible to necessarily pigeonhole this as a 6-3 court or a 3-3-3 court, is that if you look at all of the decisions that were released yesterday, and there were a couple of bigger ones, the conservatives were all over the map because they're trying to interpret the law, okay? They're not, for the most part, doing this on politics. I think that the chief, interestingly, is more likely to respond to politics than any of the rest of them. But because when you are engaging deeply and intellectually in the pursuit of law, you often do come up with different positions. And these, I would encourage everyone to go read all of the many concurrences and dissents that came out this week, because they really show that intellectual vibrancy. And it's something, unfortunately, you don't see as much on the liberal side of the court, which so obviously and often does make up the law as they go, join together in supporting one of the justices' views and respond to the political environment.
The second big case on Thursday was this challenge to Obamacare that Kim raised. And to set this one up, remember that in 2012, the Chief Justice John Roberts saved the individual mandate, the requirement that every American buy insurance, by essentially ruling that the penalty attached to it, if you didn't have insurance, was really a tax. And then in 2017, Congress set the tax to $0. So this case was essentially saying, now it's not, now it can't be a tax because it's a $0 tax. And so you have to strike it down. And Bill, that was dismissed 7-2 with Justice Stephen Breyer writing the opinion. And essentially the court just said that the parties don't have standing to sue over a provision that now does nothing.
Right. They left the substantive question unaddressed. You know, further to Kim's point, this case is a perfect illustration that the really interesting debates are among the Republican justices. You know, the Democratic appointed justices generally sort of behave like a Democratic legislature. What's the outcome Democrats want? And they provide it as a rule. But this, again, I thought the dissent was really interesting. I think it was Alito and Gorsuch, right? Alito called it the third installment in our epic Affordable Care Act trilogy. But to me, the most persuasive was Clarence Thomas, who was very sympathetic to Alito's position, but he basically came down with the majority because he didn't believe the plaintiffs had standing. And, you know, standing sounds like a technicality, but standing is really essential to the understanding of separation of powers, because if you grant anyone standing, then you're creating an opening for the court essentially to become either a legislature or executive by just, you know, getting, you know, getting the plaintiff they want and then ruling the way they want and substituting their opinion either for the president's or Congress's. So I thought Thomas was very persuasive. And he also dinged the progressive side, you know, for taking some of the giving standing to some of these other cases. But he said, look, just because they've done it in past cases, you know, we shouldn't do it in this case. We have to decide this on the merits. And he thought on the merits they lacked the standing. And so I thought that was an incredibly principled stand. And he, you know, again, he gave a nod to the dissent.
Yeah, Thomas is clearly sympathetic to the idea that these Obamacare cases have created a kind of a Jenga tower of too clever by half arguments. But to have standing to sue like this, you need to have three things. You need to have an injury that is, in the terms, fairly traceable to the law that you're challenging. And then it has to be redressable by the court. And what Breyer said here, there's a couple of individual plaintiffs in this case who said that they were forced to buy insurance that they didn't want or they didn't need. And what Breyer's opinion essentially says is there's no injury that's traceable to that mandate. Quote, with the penalty zeroed out, the IRS can no longer seek a penalty from those who fail to comply. Because of this, there's no possible government action that is causally connected to the plaintiff's injury, unquote. I guess what I would add on top of that, Kim, is even if they got past the standing phase, I still am skeptical that the challengers to Obamacare would have gotten what they wanted, because what they wanted was for the individual mandate to be struck down and the court to say, we can't separate the mandate from the rest of the law. So if the mandate goes, the rest of the law goes too. And the argument that I'm persuaded by that was percolating even as the case worked its way up was that when Congress set the penalty to zero, it essentially severed the mandate, because Congress changed the law in such a way that it turned the mandate off and left the rest of the law alone. I don't know what you think of that argument.
Well, first of all, just back on the standing thing, I certainly get the argument. And I think it's notable, as you and Bill have both pointed out, that even Justice Clarence Thomas was somewhat persuaded by that. And so as a result, joined the majority there. But I think what's also notable, and I think this gets to your argument too, is that your follow-on one about the merits of the case. I think the Alito and Gorsuch dissent is really important, because whatever the case law here, they did point out that the court has in many, many cases been, and I will quote them here, selectively generous in allowing states to sue. And that is absolutely the case. It seems as though the court willy-nilly grants standing depending on whether or not they really want to either handle the merits of a case or simply look like they are handling the merits of the case when in fact they're trying to avoid it. So, you know, for instance, a court granted standing to Democratic states challenging a citizenship question on the census, even though the states weren't directly injured by that question and only thought that they might be. So while they didn't really get into it specifically, one of the things you can read from that Alito and Gorsuch defense is they were highlighting the fact that from a 100-foot perspective, one of the things that the majority did here is save John Roberts from the mess he made all the way back in the beginning when he decided to step up and try to save this law by declaring the individual mandate a tax. And ever since then, the court has been twisting itself in knots to somehow maintain that position. And so I think what the Alito Gorsuch dissent was sort of pointing out is, here we go again. We're doing this again. This time we're doing it because we're saying that people don't have standing and therefore we don't have to get to the merits of it. Now, on your point about, you know, would they have lost anyway on the merits? Well, you know, the dissent notes that actually maybe Texas and states had standing because other provisions burden them and are linked to the mandate. And so that would have at least, you know, maybe got a hearing by a greater number of judges. But in this case, they decided to simply avoid having to exercise their minds in that direction.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that the standing, throwing it out on standing, prevents the Chief Justice from having to reach the question of whether the mandate is now actually unconstitutional. But what I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there were not a lot of great legal minds that were saying, predicting that this was going to be a successful case. Quite the opposite. And yet, as you mentioned earlier, Kim, that is not what Democrats were saying. That's not the story that they were telling when Judge Barrett, then Judge Barrett, was nominated and being confirmed. And so I'll read a couple quotes here, one from Chuck Schumer. A vote by any senator for Judge Amy Coney Barrett is a vote to strike down the Affordable Care Act and eliminate protections for millions of Americans with pre-existing conditions. Or if you want somebody on the House side, here's Nancy Pelosi. If this nominee is confirmed, millions of families' health care will be ripped away in the middle of a pandemic, unquote. And Bill, I mean, that's obviously not what happened. Justice Barrett did not rule with the dissenters here. She ruled with the Chief Justice. And yet it seems to me that was fairly predictable, even when Schumer and Pelosi were making those comments.
Yes, it gets back to the principle we said before. I mean, I think Democrats basically accuse Republican-appointed justices of doing what they do. I mean, you look at most of the Democratic justices, and they seem to size up what does the Democratic Party want the policy outcome to be, and then they get there by whatever kind of legal argument they need. Whereas there is real debate on how to apply principles and what the weight of principles are. You know, again, even going back to our previous discussion, it was Scalia that wrote the Employment Division versus Smith decision, which I think is surprising to a lot of people. So there's real ferment. I mean, I don't think it's something we should discourage on the right. There's real ferment on saying, well, what should we be doing, and trying to reason their way to an argument. But you're right, this was not predicted, but that's the way that they try to tarnish anyone nominated by a Republican president, and try to tarnish them and predict all these dire things are going to happen. And it never turns out that way.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.